Sam Betsano, Nazuda, Amjil Tusi.
That's Matt Hurrell, who got back from Mongolia last July after serving 2 years as a Peace Corps volunteer, wishing all listeners of the Charlottesville Podcasting Network hello and good luck. Matt is just one of three returned Peace Corps volunteers we talked to for the special podcast commemorating the 45th anniversary of the Peace Corps and the University of Virginia's special role in the agency's history. We'll hear from Matt a bit later on, as well as fellow volunteers Sarah Johnston and Bob Vernon. But first, the Peace Corps was signed into existence by executive order of President John F. Kennedy on March 1, 1961. The idea was for the Corps to serve, in Kennedy's words, as a pool of trained American men and women to help foreign countries meet urgent needs for skilled manpower.
We will send Americans abroad who are qualified to do a job. We will send those abroad who are committed to the concept which motivates the Peace Corps. It will not be easy. None of the men and women will be paid a salary. They will live at the same level as the citizens of the country which they're sent to, doing the same work, eating the same food, speaking the same language. We're going to put particular emphasis on those men and women who have skills in teaching, agriculture, and in health. I'm hopeful that it will be a source of satisfaction to Americans and a contribution to world peace.
In the 45 years since Kennedy's vision became reality, the University of Virginia has had the distinction of sending the most volunteers to the service of any mid-sized university, with over 800 since 1961 and over 400 since 2000. This accomplishment was honored on March 15, 2006, in special ceremonies on the UVA grounds in the dome room of the Rotunda. One of the speakers was Jody Olson, deputy director of the Peace Corps and a former volunteer herself, having served in Tunisia. Olson gave an update on how the Corps has measured up since 1961.
We are 180,000 returned Peace Corps volunteers, having served in 137 countries worldwide. As returned volunteers, we are bringing our experiences back home. As teachers, one volunteer who's in a charter school in New York City that is primarily with immigrants from the Dominican Republic, and she shares her Dominican Republic Peace Corps experience with them. As educators, we have a number of college presidents who are returned Peace Corps volunteers, University of Missouri, who's your competitor in the Thomas Jefferson Historical Society, is a returned Peace Corps volunteer. Educators, public officials at local, state, and national levels, mayors, two current governors, six members of Congress, for example. Business leaders, founder of Netflix, so be sure and rent your DVDs. Nonprofit, domestic, international leaders, and significant shapers of international programs and development policies. Today, we are 7,810 currently serving volunteers in 74 countries, the highest in 30 years. And we are very proud of this figure and of the commitment that Americans have to serve today. I had lunch recently with a first-generation Indian American who had been serving in Nepal just before it closed. And he told me about his own community in Nepal and asking him what it was like being a first-generation Indian American serving in Nepal, you know, vis-a-vis the community and other volunteers. He said, well, what do you mean? In addition to myself, in our community was a Japanese American, a Korean American, a volunteer whose family was from Central America, and an African American. The Nepali community learned much about America, and the volunteers learned much about each other as Americans. This is part of what Peace Corps is today.
Today, Bob Vernon is a resident of Charlottesville, but 33 years ago, he was a Peace Corps volunteer. Let's hear his story.
I graduated from the University of Virginia in 1970 and had planned to join the Peace Corps before I graduated, and so I was one of these people that didn't really have to go out and look for a job. I already had something lined up, and I ended up in Puerto Rico in a training program that was to go to Panama in July 1970, and later went into another training program that took me to Venezuela in 1971. I was a Peace Corps volunteer in La Grita, Estado Táchira, Venezuela, from January 71 to January 73. I had studied German all through high school, and I studied German in college. I didn't speak any Spanish, but I had a very good professor here at UVA, the late C. Allen Hutchinson, and I think I probably took 20 or 30 hours of Latin American history from him. And one of the things that I wanted to do was to live in an Andean country, or at least a country where the population was strongly Native American. There was a sense of service, that everyone owes the country a little bit of service sometime. Training programs at that time were about 3 months. When I went into Puerto Rico, I did not speak a word of Spanish. They put us up in a pensión, and we had 8 hours of Spanish class for 3 days, and in Wednesday they gave us a little handout that we were supposed to memorize all the phrases on that, and then Thursday they assigned us a barrio, a community, around Ponce, Puerto Rico. And then on Friday we were sent out into that community, and we were told, you know, go from house to house, go from bar to bar, however you do it, find a family to live with for the next 3 months. So total immersion, that's how you learn Spanish, that's how you pick up a culture. After you finish your training program, they sit down and they interview everyone, and they decide, where can we place you best? And in discussing all of this, this was an agricultural program, and they were saying that, you know, I'd done really well, I'd learned Spanish really, really fast, rapidly. But they perceived that maybe I wasn't all that keen about agriculture. And the trainers suggested that I might join another program that would go someplace else and engage in some other activity that I enjoyed more. At this point, you see, they have 3 months invested in my training, and one of the things that they don't want is for you to go overseas, to be stationed in country, and to be dissatisfied and to quit after 6 months or 3 months. So they make a real effort to place you where they think you'll fit in. And they said, well, we notice you play volleyball, and your resume says you ran track and cross country. Maybe we could get you into a sports and recreation program. That's what I was assigned to. And then in January of 71, we went in country, and I was assigned to La Grita and spent 2 years there. At that time, I believe the community had about 5,000, maybe 7,000 people living in the city. It was an old city. It was founded in 1576. It takes a little while to fit in. What really helped adjust to being there was taking on a role that people understood. So rather than just saying, you know, well, I'm here as a coach and I'm going to train kids for the national sports program, which is the way our job was described, I talked to some people and felt that maybe doing something like being the rotating phys ed teacher, like many of us had in primary school, maybe that would be a way to have an identity that people could understand. To be quite honest, I was happiest after my first year. I'd learned enough Spanish that just felt like, you know, I was living like a regular person, doing regular things with regular people. You pick up the culture, you pick up the lifestyle. I got used to the siestas that they have that last about 2 hours, where they don't really take a nap or anything like that, but, you know, there's a break, and the kids go home and they have lunch and they come back after a couple of hours. And, you know, you get used to that pattern of life. You get used to different social distances in Latin society. You know, you sit right down, right up next to a person when you talk to them. You don't sort of keep a social distance that Americans would be more comfortable with.
Bob Vernon says he got very used to the pace of life in La Grita and had some troubles adjusting when he got back home.
One of the things that was really strange for me was going into grocery stores. In Venezuela, I would buy one or two things at a time from the little old lady who ran the corner bodega. You know, I'd go in and I'd buy a tomato or two, or I'd go to the meat market and I'd buy a pound of meat, or I'd go to the mercado and maybe I'd buy some bananas and fruit or what have you. And all of these purchases were sort of very person to person, one or two things at a time. And it was very strange being back here to go into Safeway at that time in Charlottesville and to load up a shopping cart with all of these things that you're taking into your house, and everybody sees all this stuff and they all know what you're taking into your house. I mean, this is really strange.
Bob has not been back to Venezuela since then, but says taking 2 years out of his life for the Corps helped inform his worldview. Since La Grita, he spent a good portion of his life volunteering for various organizations, and he recommends others do the same.
I'd like to tell you something about my sight. Well, it's got its share of dust and strong sunlight.
Now you're listening to a cover of a famous Indigo Girls song, with new lyrics written by Sarah Johnston, currently a graduate student in UVA's Curry School of Education.
So we jump in the river, we camp on the cliff tops, we drink untreated water, we wear out our old flip-flops. Barbara will be there to treat our ailments, and I know that she will check for hives.
The Peace Corps experience, one of the things that you do in training is you really think about yourself and how do you deal with stress. It's stressful at some points. It is lonely at some points. It's overwhelming at some points. It's boring at some points. And what do you do with that? And how can you creatively access that to support yourself? And one of the things that I learned about myself was that I made up silly songs.
He told me that my work would make a difference, but it was something I might never see.
Johnston served in Namibia and the Gambia from 1998 through the end of 2000, an experience she treasures for having broadened her perspective on the world. Here's her story.
I decided to go into the Peace Corps when I was 30. I had dreamed about the Peace Corps probably since I was in the third grade. And I had an aunt who had been a missionary overseas, and my brother later went into Peace Corps right out of college, and I visited him when I was a college student. And then after college, I got into the work atmosphere and started working, and Peace Corps sort of slipped by, but I continued to think about it. And then I had, when I was about 30, I guess when I was 29, a loved one in my family died, and I was just thinking, life is really short, and this is something I've always dreamed to do, and I'm going to do it. Peace Corps always looks for people that have a commitment to volunteering, and I had been a volunteer. I had tutored in the classroom for a long time, and I also worked in informal education with media. I worked in public broadcasting, so I had some of those skills. And I also, because I had always thought I wanted to do Peace Corps, I actually took some classes at night on teaching English as a foreign language. With a bachelor's degree, you have a lot of opportunities to do Peace Corps. And by showing that you're interested and have a volunteer spirit, if you are volunteering and being active in the community, that shows Peace Corps that you might be a good representative. Peace Corps is not for everyone. But I tell you, it has changed my life. I will never look at the world the same way ever again. I was in Kongola, the village of Kongola, which is the first stop into Western Caprivi. So I was surrounded by animal parks, actually. So there were actually elephant crossing signs where I lived. I lived in a mud hut without running water or electricity, but I was quite comfortable. I had a gas-powered stove, and I had a filter system where I would boil and filter my water. My first day actually was very, very slow. You know, And I was the first volunteer in this region of Namibia. They'd never met Americans before. And I was in a country where blonde-headed people might not have been the most welcome, because that was the Afrikaans. I was in a country that had just gotten over apartheid and a war with South Africa. And there was a lot of things going on. And I remember being my first day in the village. I was nearly attacked by some dogs, And people were just looking at me in a stony way. And then I sort of broke out into my Solozzi that I had learned in training and saw frowns melt into smiles, and knowing that my effort to come into this community was going to be welcomed. My first day, my hut flooded and there was a hole in my wall. And I'm like, what did I get myself into? But it worked out. Everybody came with buckets and mops and mopped it all up, and it was fine. It was fine. And I fell in love. It was almost a love affair. It was with all the ups and downs. I was assigned as a primary school teacher trainer, and I was in the community. One of the things that Namibia had done in its needs assessment for what they needed is there were all of these rural schools, especially primary and combined up to middle school level, where the teachers, some of them only had eighth grade educations. And this was under apartheid. A lot of people were not, it was not beneficial for them to have higher education in that time. They didn't want them, the teachers, to have higher education. So their math and their English skills were very poor. At the time, it was very lecture-centered, so you're having a lecture format to first graders or five-year-olds, which doesn't really work. So I was there to talk about, to work with teachers and give them training on how to do group activities. So one of the things I had to do, since the classes were in Solozzi, is I had to learn Solozzi, and I did a lot of team teaching. And I would spend my evenings working with individual teachers on doing their lesson plans. I also had workshops on how they could pass their equivalent of the GED so that they could keep their jobs. And, cause in a couple years' time, they were going to lose their credentials if they didn't pass this test. So I did a lot of work like that. I also did a tremendous amount on health. There's a lot of HIV AIDS prevention work that's going on and sensitization work. I also worked on malaria prevention, talking to people about hygiene and how germs are spread and so forth, water cleaning and so forth. I was the only volunteer in my village. There was someone that was about 15 kilometers away, and then I could go to town and hitchhike. I could get a ride into town where I had my post office. I shared a post box, and that was about 115 kilometers away. Namibia is a large country. It's a small population, but it's a large country, and I lived in the Caprivi Strip, which at the time, while I was there, there was a rebellion that went on, and Peace Corps takes safety and security so seriously, and I had to leave after the rebellion. I knew that people were looking out for me, and we all left. But Peace Corps has not gone back into the Caprivi Strip. I hope that they will, because they definitely need to. They are in other regions of Namibia, and that's fine. But this was one region that was having some civil unrest, and I had to leave for that reason. My heart was broken. It really was broken. But I think I did make some kind of difference, and they certainly made a difference in me.
After Namibia, Sarah was transferred to the Gambia on the west coast of Africa, just below Senegal. After that posting, she returned home and is now pursuing studies in instructional technology, possibly to take back to Africa one day in the future. And there's that greeting from Matt Hurrell again. Matt served in Mongolia from 2003 to 2005 as an English teacher. He says he had been thinking about serving overseas for a long time before he took the plunge.
I had known that I wanted to do Peace Corps pretty much from high school. And then I finished school. I went to school for architecture. And after 4 years of that, I was a little bit burnt out. And so I decided that that would be a good way to take the skills that I had and see if I could apply them in a different way. I got there, I think, June 4th, and by June 6th, I was actually living with a Mongolian family. I didn't have any language. We showed up, I had my phrase book, and I was pointing at things, and then they were pointing at things and saying what they were, and I was looking at the phrase book and realizing that those didn't sound anything like what I would have pronounced them as, and trying to work with that. But then the next day we had language training, and so I came in, I learned to say hello, my name is, and this and that. I went home, I had a 1 minute talk with my host family, and then they were chattering away and probably laughing at me, and I had no idea what was going on again. But they also, during those first 2.5 months, it was all language training and cross-cultural awareness training. There was some technical training for teaching English. I had to teach a class of students and have it observed and got comments on it and things like that. We learned how to cook some Mongolian food. They taught us how to chop wood, just in case anyone never chopped wood before, things like that. I chose Central/East Asia, thinking that I would probably end up in China because I'd spent some time there, and I had a little bit of Chinese language experience. But the China program actually got canceled because of SARS that year, and I was in the Central East Asia pool, and so then Peace Corps suggested Mongolia, and I said that was great. And actually now I'm glad that I ended up there over China, just because it was a completely different experience. I was living in Tuolaimik, which is the central district in Mongolia, and the name of my town was Dzongmad, which was the provincial capital of my province. So it was a town of, they said it was about 17,000 people, but that was divided up into these four districts, one of which was about 2 miles away. So really, within the center part of town where I lived, it was more like 8,000. And well, probably about 75% of those people were still living in traditional housing tents. So it would be kind of like if Richmond had 18,000 people and about 14,000 of them lived in a tent. I mean, you don't really know what welcoming is like until you go to a place like that, where you could eat at one of your friends' houses every day for a week, and they wouldn't even think twice about it. They'd actually be excited that you were there, and they would never expect you to return the favor. I mean, they just do things for you without expecting anything in return. The main reason I decided to do it when I left is because I thought it would be a challenge. It was kind of the most difficult thing I could think of. And it turned out to be true that it was probably one of the most difficult things I've ever done, but not in the reasons that I thought it was. Living without some of the things that I had here was not nearly as difficult as just trying to interact with a culture that you'd never had any experience with before. It was a lot more difficult than I thought it was going to be. I mean, that was also the best part, is the thing is that it was difficult to relate to people sometimes, but when you actually were able to make connections with people, it was easily the best part of being there. And in Mongolia, nothing ever starts on time. So nobody expects it to. Nobody really tries to get it to start on time. But it's the kind of thing where, there might be a thing that says be there at 7, and it won't actually get started until 10 o'clock at night or something. Or there's a lot of times when it'll start the next day. Or, if something just doesn't get finished, it doesn't really matter. People just go on. So it's kind of nice because there's not so much pressure to get everything done really quickly. But if you have something you want to do and nobody's showing up, it can become kind of difficult. One of the things that was difficult for me was they don't ever live alone in Mongolia. You live with your family when you're younger, then you get married and you move in with your husband or wife, and probably even then you're still living with your family. You may be your mom and dad, and you and your spouse and your children might all share the same gir, which is like a yurt, like a tent that they live in. And so they didn't understand why I live by myself. And so they'd be coming over all the time. People would always be over at my house. And it got to be where I really wanted to be alone sometimes to read and think about what was going on. And it was difficult because I never was able to find that opportunity until I tried to explain to them that when I'm by myself, I'm not depressed. I'm not sitting in my house, sad because nobody's around. I'm really just, that's what I want. And they didn't understand it. And it took a really long time for them to be able to trust me that I was doing okay when I was by myself. You just start to realize that not only that I knew that it was, they wanted me to be there, so I wanted to hang out with them, but also that it's even the little things that you do are probably the most important things you do while you're in Peace Corps. And so it was less the projects that I did and things and the teaching that I did that was important than the relationships that I made and the things that I helped them to realize about, American culture and just the world in general, I think. Peace Corps, a lot of times it can be extremely frustrating, and you have to have a lot of patience going into it. I think if you go into Peace Corps with a type A personality, you're pretty much going to come back a type B. And if you already started out as someone who's pretty relaxed, your house could pretty much burn down in front of you, and you would just shrug your shoulders and start going through the ashes. Like, it wouldn't really bother you, because you can't really expect the level of things that will occur there. It's just, a lot of times it's nothing you've ever experienced before. And so I feel like I'm a lot more laid back now, probably a lot more patient. Able to deal with situations, able to give up control of situations, more aware of the fact that you can't always control everything. And I think that's difficult for a lot of Americans who go to other countries to realize.
Matt is now the Peace Corps' on-grounds recruiter for UVA and is helping the school maintain its reputation as one of the nation's top schools for sending volunteers. At the ceremony marking this distinction, Peace Corps Deputy Director Jody Olson wondered aloud just why this is.
It must represent the culture of this university, the culture of the faculty, the culture of the programs available to students, and obviously the culture that the students themselves bring to the institution to make this commitment to service. This is extraordinary, and I think one of the finest records in the United States in terms of Peace Corps recruitment.
But can the Peace Corps really make a difference in the world? Perhaps to answer that question, let's let Jody Olson tell the story of how one Peace Corps volunteer ultimately affected the life of a nation by coming into contact with a young boy.
About 35 years ago, a Peace Corps volunteer went to Peru. As she walked down the street on her first day, she ran into a 12-year-old boy who said, "Why don't you come and live with us?" Which meant him, his 11 brothers and sisters, and parents in a three-room house without plumbing or electricity. And surprisingly, this 12-year-old boy's mother agreed to take in this straggling Peace Corps volunteer on her first day in the village. That began 2 years of sharing a language, family life, and stories. When the volunteer got married the next year to another volunteer, her husband joined her in this house, in this little room. They spent time with the boy, encouraging him, understanding him, and he them. They then stayed in touch when they returned to the States and later encouraged him to come to San Francisco for college. Last week, now over 35 years later, that boy, Alejandro Toledo, now president of Peru, came to Peace Corps and spoke. He said so pointedly that he owed who he is to this couple, the Meisners, who lived with him and his family starting when he was 12 years old.
And that's it for our special podcast on the Peace Corps and the role the University of Virginia has played in its history. If you'd like to find out more about the Peace Corps, visit the website at peacecorps.gov. This is the Charlottesville Podcasting Network, your source for high-quality programming about Central Virginia and beyond. CPN is a public community service of Wordcast Productions. Visit wordcast.biz for more information on how Wordcast can help you or your company spread your message to the world. I'm Sean Tubbs. Thanks for listening.